Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Ayala. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's program update on glioblastoma. And today's program is a collaborative program between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today, and also because, of course, of your interest in this program as well. So I do also want to particularly call out to some of the brain tumor organizations that are actually partnering on today's program, the Brain Tumor Foundation and Brain Cancer Initiative, Chris Elliott Fund, and National Brain Tumor Society. And I really want to thank them as well as all the other organizations for really helping to spread the word about this program. Now, we have on the program today over 431 participants, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Algeria, Canada, France, Greece, India, Japan, United Kingdom, and the United Arab Emirates. So we really have participants from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you have chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, today's activity, today's program, is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. And we have wonderful speakers on our program today, really the best, and so I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce. Dr. Bruce is Edgar M. Halsbian Professor of Neurological Surgery, Vice Chairman, Department of Neurosurgery, Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, Co-Director, Brain Tumor Center, Director, Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Laboratory. And Dr. Bruce is going to be addressing overview of glioblastoma, current standard of care, novel treatment approaches, the role of immunotherapy, and communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bruce.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here with Cancer Care. You know, I've been involved with this organization for quite some time, and they do a terrific job providing a great service for education and support for patients and their families with any kind of tumors, but in particular those with brain tumors that we're going to talk about today. Now, let me begin by saying this is really an exciting time to be in the brain tumor field, as there are many new advances in both the treatment and diagnosis of glioblastoma. In fact, there are more people working on brain tumors now than at any time in our history. Glioblastomas are what is known as primary brain tumors. That is, they begin in the brain and they grow from within. This is different from metastatic brain tumors, which are tumors that have spread from somewhere else in the body into the brain. Now, glioblastomas are malignant brain tumors. They can spread to other parts of the brain or spinal cord, but they rarely spread to other parts of the body. They are invasive, so most of the treatment is designed to control the tumor at the location in the brain where the tumor begins. And although there are researchers who are trying to determine what causes brain tumors, at this point, no one truly knows. It should be clear that nothing you did caused your brain tumor, and there was nothing you could have done to prevent it. Glioblastomas are diagnosed when patients develop any of a number of symptoms, including headaches, seizures, balance problems, weakness, speech difficulties, and the diagnosis is usually made following an MRI scan. The current standard of care relies on surgery, followed by 6 weeks of radiation, and then chemotherapy with a drug called Temodar. In the treatment of glioblastoma, the goal of surgery is to try and remove as much tumor as possible. And depending on where the tumor is located, a surgeon may be able to remove most of it or only a small part of it. And in some cases, only a biopsy may be reasonable. The problem is that these tumors invade into the normal brain, so it is not possible to completely remove them. The tumor cells mix in with the brain cells, and if you completely remove the tumor, you'd be removing some normal brain as well, and that wouldn't be acceptable. There are a variety of techniques and tools that make surgery now safer than ever. And surgery accomplishes two goals. One is to remove some of the mass effect on the brain that is causing pressure and causing problems from that. The other goal is to provide tissue to give to the pathologist so that he or she can make the diagnosis. Many patients are on steroids after the surgery to try and reduce the amount of swelling that invariably occurs after surgery. Now, these steroids can have some side effects, including an increased appetite, weight gain, acne, mood changes, stomach irritation, and difficulty sleeping. Anticonvulsants are medications that are given to prevent seizures. Not everybody needs this medication, but those that do benefit from the ability to prevent seizures. Side effects from this can be allergies or dizziness or fatigue. And once the surgery is complete and the patient has recovered, he or she will undergo 30 treatments of radiation therapy. This is generally given Monday through Friday for 6 weeks. It is generally painless, but some of the side effects can include hair loss, tiredness, and skin irritation. These symptoms generally get better once the radiation is complete. Chemotherapy is often given as well, and the standard chemotherapy is a drug called temozolomide, otherwise known as Temodar. This drug has been shown to be effective at slowing down the tumor growth. It's sometimes given during the radiation and sometimes given after the radiation. In any event, it is effective in any manner that it is given. So surgery, radiation, and Temodar are the current standard of care for patients with glioblastoma. Now, when a tumor grows back after the standard treatment, then one of the many novel experimental treatments becomes an option. The novel treatment approaches that most people are familiar with involve different types of chemotherapy. There are many new drugs being developed all the time that are designed to target the growth of brain tumors. Some of the newer treatment approaches include ways to alter the chemotherapy so that it gets into the brain at a better penetration. It's able to get in there better. Also, many of these drugs are designed to have less side effects and to be more effective at killing tumor cells. With the advances in the research laboratories in molecular biology techniques, scientists have been able to determine some very detailed molecular and genetic analyses of individual tumors. This has led to a lot of excitement into what is being called personalized therapy. This means that scientists can analyze any person's tumor and determine what parts of the tumor are causing the growth and emphasize the fact that these different parts that are causing the growth can be different in each person's tumor. So every person's tumor is a little bit different than a next person's tumor. And with that in mind, it may be possible to develop special drugs that target these individual problems in a given person's tumor. This work is very preliminary. It has not been developed to the point where it can be mass-produced for every person, but that's hopefully something on the horizon in the near future. There are a variety of other types of drugs that are being developed that are designed to do things like affecting the blood vessels in the brain or blocking the invasion of the tumor cells into the brain. In terms of new developments, there's also some exciting areas of development in gene therapy and the use of viruses to attack certain parts of the tumor. Now, these treatments are part of a trend that is known as biological therapies, where specialized viruses or bacteria or products from them can be used to kill cancer cells. These sophisticated treatments have been worked out in research laboratory for many years and are just getting into the clinic now. And they are holding out a lot of hope because they represent entirely new approaches to treatment. One of One of the very promising areas for brain tumors is the field of immunotherapy. And these are treatments that use vaccines and other strategies to help the body's own immune system to eliminate the tumor. The immune system in human beings is really remarkable. Your immune system is what allows you to get rid of viruses and bacteria that cause the flu and other types of infections. Basically, the immune system recognizes viruses and bacteria as foreign invaders, and these are then destroyed by immune cells in the body, just like the Pac-Man video game. Interestingly, the immune system recognizes tumor cells like glioblastoma as foreign invaders as well, and it responds by stimulating an immune response. Unfortunately, the tumor cells grow faster than the immune system can destroy them. So even though your body is mounting an immune response, the immune response is relatively weak. So much of the research that's being done now is designing new vaccines or drugs that can boost the immune system response. And many of these drugs have been very effective at enhancing the immune system and also blocking some of the parts of the tumor that seem to inhibit the immune system overall. So much of this immunotherapy work is still at a very early stage, but these results are very provocative and promising, and it's one of the major trends in brain tumor research right now. There are a number of very promising drugs that have been developed and that are being tested, and there are a number of plans to use these in combination with other immunotherapies such as vaccines and other very sophisticated vaccine-like treatments. Finally, I want to move on and talk a little bit about communicating with your healthcare team. First of all, I would say it is important to seek reputable specialists, and it is helpful to find people who are specialists specifically in brain tumors. And it is easier than ever to find these people with the use of the internet. Every major city has one or more places where these specialists can be found. And also, by working with support groups and groups like Cancer Care, finding these specialists can be easily accomplished. You know, it's important to have some control over your lifestyle when you're first diagnosed with a brain tumor and you need to communicate with your healthcare team. Just given the inconveniences of having to see doctors and getting tests and treatment is a major stress. So keeping a notebook or using your smartphone to jot down notes and reminders help to make sure that you're not overwhelmed by dealing with your condition. This way, when you see your doctor, you can make sure that your questions are answered, and you can make sure that their instructions are understood. It's important to keep an honest dialogue with your family so that they understand what you're going through and can help you make the decisions that need to be made in terms of your treatment going forward. I would also be skeptical of anecdotes, no matter how well-meaning. Seems like when you're diagnosed with a brain tumor, all sorts of people come up to you and tell you the story of their family member or friend of a friend, and that may not always be very helpful. For one thing, there are no two patients who are exactly alike, and I would be careful about trying to apply something you've heard about in another patient to your specific case. It may also be useful to have second opinions if time is available. Having other opinions can help refine and formulate your questions, and it's important to work with your healthcare team and friends and family so that you can maintain the highest quality of life possible. This is very doable. Just because you have a brain tumor, no one is saying that you can't visit a mall or enjoy a birthday party or have a nice meal or see a good movie. It's important to continue to live your life to the highest degree possible, despite any diagnosis or side effects that you may be suffering. This is by far the best way to cope with your tumor. I want to finish now by reminding you that there are many groups of outstanding researchers and physicians who have put together a lot of thoughtful ideas on how best to treat brain tumors. And the research being done is more sophisticated than ever, and the optimism for finding better treatments and improving the quality of life has really never been greater. I'm going to stop here and turn the program over to Dr. Eric Wong. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bruce. That was really outstanding and really very lots of wonderful information for everybody to absorb and to have questions for you during the Q&A. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Eric Wong. And Dr. Wong is Associate Professor, Harvard Medical School, Director of the Neuro-Oncology Unit, Co-Director, Brain Tumor Center, Department of Neurology, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Dr. Wong is going to address electric field treatments, the importance of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, managing symptoms and treatment side effects, and the role of rehabilitation medicine. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Wong.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn and Jeff and Jeffrey for giving the introduction and for inviting me back this year to Cancer Care Teleconference. And there are certainly a lot of exciting research that is going on in the field of treating glioblastomas. One of the more recent technologies that has come into the treatment of glioblastoma is this therapy called electric fields treatment. And it is called tumor-treating electric fields. And the Food and Drug Administration actually approved it for the treatment of recurrent glioblastoma in 2011. And just a little bit over a year and a half ago, in 2015, it was approved for use in newly diagnosed glioblastoma. Now, this is a new type of therapy, and think of this as slow radiation. And what do I mean by that? The kind of radiation that patients with glioblastoma get, just like what Dr. Bruce has spoken about, involves ionizing radiation. This is not ionizing radiation. This is lower energy, and therefore patients have to wear it and receive it for a longer period of time. And patients wear these arrays on their head. They have to shave their hair, and they have to carry an electric field generator with them. The toxicity is primarily on the scalp. It is in the form of a rash, which can be lessened by the application of a potent steroid. And family members who are responsible for exchanging the arrays have to check on the scalp. And in severe cases, it may require a treatment holiday. Now, the battery and also the electric field generator weighs about 3 pounds. And because of hair growth, patients may need to shave their head once every 3 to 4 days. There are a number of things that you can do to maximize benefits if you are on this type of therapy. The first is that past analysis has shown that if you use the minimum dose of dexamethasone, it will help this therapy or whatever therapies that you are getting for your glioblastoma to work better. And dexamethasone is a steroid. It is an immunosuppressant. So whatever you can do to reduce the dose of Decadron would be helpful. Keeping the arrays on for more than 75% of the time, and that is approximately 18 hours a day, has been shown to produce a bigger benefit. And usually the responders on this therapy usually have to wear it for 6 months or longer. So this is what I mean by slow radiation. This is the kind of radiation that is lower energy, but it is the cumulative aspect that is going to affect glioblastoma control. And These three things, the use of dexamethasone, the minimizing the use of dexamethasone, keeping the arrays on for more than 75% of the time or approximately more than 18 hours a day, and keeping it on for 6 months or longer are factors that patients and their physicians can actually control. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about the importance of clinical trials, because the electric field therapy actually came out from two large-scale phase 3 clinical trials. The reason why clinical trials are important for glioblastoma patients is because clinical trials are ways to improve our existing therapy. So let me give you an example. Before 2005, when patients with newly diagnosed glioblastoma, they only received radiation upfront. After 2005, because of this large-scale clinical trial that was done by adding temozolomide, every patient with newly diagnosed glioblastoma now receives temozolomide during the 6 weeks of radiation that they are getting. And it actually improved the median survival of patients. And more importantly, it increases the survival of those patients at 2 years from 10% to 25%. And also, it increases the proportion of patients who are doing well at 5 years. And in 2011, 2015, the addition of Tumor Treating Field actually pushed this benefit even further. There are exciting immune therapies that are being tested right now, as Dr. Bruce has alluded to. There are a number of drugs that are developed by large pharmaceutical companies that you probably heard about that are called checkpoint inhibitors. And these are antibodies that can help to take the bricks off the body's immunosuppressive mechanisms to allow the body's immune systems to get rid of the glioblastoma. And there are some exciting phase 2 and phase 3 clinical trials that are ongoing right now. There are also vaccines that are being tested for glioblastoma. They are either in the form of peptides, known peptides that are known to trigger the body's immune system to attack the glioblastoma, or one can make a personalized vaccine. And the personalized vaccine is actually made from patients' tumors. So, for example, Dr. Bruce would operate on a patient and remove the tumor, and then the tumor would go to a tumor immunology laboratory, and the tumor would be processed, grind up in a way, and then so that the antigens are released and sensitize the patient's dendritic cells and allow the dendritic cells to effect the vaccine's positive effect on the patient's tumor. There's also a specialized type of T cells called CAR T cells, and it is an acronym for chimeric antigen receptor T cells, and these are, think of this as designer T cells to destroy the glioblastoma. It is still in the preliminary stage of clinical trial testing, but these are exciting immune therapies that are coming into the picture for glioblastoma patients. Now, I just want to touch base on a little bit about how research contributes to your treatment choices. A lot of the times, patients come to my clinic and say, oh, should I pick experimental treatment versus conventional treatment? This is what I tell them usually. I tell them that the patients as well as their physicians should figure out a path so that they can go through as many of the treatment as possible. Typically, experimental therapies are more restrictive to get to because there are specific inclusion and exclusion criteria that patients have to fulfill or the doctors have to fulfill. And they are just simply more restrictive, harder to get. So if patients qualify for an experimental treatment, take the experimental treatment first, because if that works, great, because the patients would be the first beneficiary of the treatment. If it doesn't work, they can always fall back on the conventional treatment. So this is an important thing. You should be making the decision together with your physician, with your treating neuro-oncologist or treating neurosurgeon, and you should be working with a team of neuro-oncologists and neurosurgeons, as well as radiation oncologists, in order to maximize the benefits of your treatment. Now, there are a number of symptoms and treatment side effects that patients may encounter during treatment. In my experience, the hardest part on the patient is actually at the beginning, when they are receiving radiation and temozolomide, and during that period of time, patients just came out from surgery, patients are healing from surgery, they may be on a higher dose of dexamethasone. So a lot of potential complications can surface. So, for example, their blood counts may drop. If their white blood cell counts drop, they may be prone to have infections. If their platelet counts drop, they may need a platelet transfusion in order to prevent bleeding. Infections can be common during that period of time. So anything that patients can do to lower their infection rate is important. And one of the things that they can do is to minimize the amount of steroid that they take. And there are other types of side effects associated with steroids, such as triggering diabetes. It can interfere with sleep. It can cause weight gain. It can cause swelling in the body. So, and because of the swelling in the brain, patients may develop neurological deficits, and this is where rehabilitation may be helpful. And patients may need physical therapy or occupational therapy in order to prevent motor symptoms or sensory symptoms. And this is particularly true for those after a seizure, because the sequela of a seizure is totally reversible. So, for example, a patient may experience motor weakness or balance problem after a seizure. It just takes these patients a little bit longer time to bounce back. So it is important to start physical therapy early, occupational therapy early, and for those with speech problems to start speech therapy early. And patients may need to stay in a rehabilitation facility briefly before they go home. Now, there's one aspect that there has been some success in terms of rehabilitation, and that is with neurocognitive deficits. And what do I mean by that? If patients have an attentional deficit, and patients with glioblastoma, because of the tumor, the treatment, or maybe both, they may have some neurocognitive deficits in terms of processing information. They may not be as quick as before, or they may lose their short-term memory. A small dose of methylphenidate or Ritalin can help these patients significantly, so that they can carry on with their activities of daily living. So I think this is a nutshell of the topics that I would like to cover, and I will turn the teleconference back to Carolyn Meissner.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wong. That was really excellent, and lots of excellent information for everybody, and wonderful information that I know there will be questions for you also during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. Andrew Chesler. Mr. Chesler is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. And Mr. Chesler will be addressing Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Mr. Chesler.
Okay. Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of the call today. I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network. when you're diagnosed with glioblastoma and how cancer care could be a part of that network, there are several ways we might be able to help. Just to tell you that Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some financial assistance, both for transportation and co-payment assistance for glioblastoma. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers, and all our services are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and we're experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and the financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. I'd like to emphasize that asking for help, whether it's by joining a support group or contacting a social worker for counseling, should be seen as a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, but also telephone and online groups that are national. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by glioblastoma. Both persons diagnosed with glioblastoma and caregivers, and along with the help of a cancer care social worker who is there to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a very powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement, a sense of community, and that can help provide additional support and guidance besides family and friends. These connections help lessen isolation, which is something that many people experience when they're diagnosed with cancer. As we've learned from today's program, today's speakers, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and your family. A cancer care social worker can help you prioritize and consider questions that you might want to ask and get the information that you need. Please remember that you're not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Please contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE. That's 800-813-4673. Or log in and visit our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. And thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Oh, thank you so much, Andrew, Ms. Chesler, my colleague. Thank you so much. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. And I'm going to ask Ayala to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. Some of you already are queuing up for questions, but we want to be sure that everybody knows how to do this. And so, Ayala, if you would explain to everyone. Also, if you would please bring all of our speakers on board so that everyone can address the questions that are asked. And we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question before the end of the call, I will give you all information about how to get your questions answered. If we didn't, or if you think of a question in a couple of days, or even today, if there's a question we didn't get to, but we're going to try to take as many as possible. Ayala?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Again, if you have a question, please press star then one.
So we have a question from one of our online participants, and I'm going to give this question to Dr. Bruce. Okay, so this question is, if EGFR status is mixed, would the patient be a candidate for targeted therapy? Dr. Bruce, if you could address this question in a general way, appreciate that.
Well, in a general way, ideally for targeted therapies, whether it's EGFR or similar targets, normally you want as many tumor cells in the tumor to have that target. So if your tumor is only partially EGFR positive, then your chances of success are clearly much less, because the definition of targeted therapy is it will only kill those tumor cells that have the specific marker that you're targeting. With that being said, there's still a lot that's not known about how these treatments work and some of the ancillary benefits from that. So to specifically answer your question, I would say you would have to ask the investigators who are running that particular trial what the criteria are for getting in, and whether having a tumor that has only partially EGFR or not is acceptable. You know, that may be specific to that particular protocol. But in general, you like as many of the tumor cells to have that marker as possible for a targeted therapy.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Wong, did you want to add anything?
Sure. I just want to add that nowadays there is patients can actually do multi-panel somatic testing for somatic mutations of the tumor. So each academic institutions may have their own in-house panel, or if they are at a place that is not near an academic medical center, they can potentially send it to these commercial companies that can run the panel for you. So, for example, in the Boston area, there's a company called Foundation Medicine, in which you can send your tumor sample there and they can test it. Now, if you find EGFR mutation or BRAF V600E mutation, if you have those specific mutations, then you can potentially get treated with a specific targeted therapy. And insurance companies now is allowing patients to get those therapies. So I think that is a very good question, and I think getting the testing done and speaking to your doctors about the drugs that may fit you is important.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. And our next question from one of our online participants is, just open this up, and I'm going to ask Dr. Wong if you would address this. Since a robust immune system is very important to enhance the effectiveness of immunotherapy, would it be better to skip the 6 cycles of chemo treatment and go directly to immunotherapy? Also, chemo really wipes out a lot of healthy cells anyway, and the effectiveness is really dubious or elusive for most GBMs. I understand chemo is currently taken as the golden standard, but the primary and ultimate goal is to help the patients. I wondered if you could comment on this, Dr. Wong, in a general way. I also asked Dr. Bruce, of course, to comment as well, but if you would start.
Okay. So, yes, I would be happy to comment that. Okay. So, in past clinical trial, the trial that I mentioned that changed standard of care in 2005 when temozolomide was added concurrent to the radiation, and then after the radiation is done, patient takes 6 cycles of adjuvant temozolomide 5 days out of the month, 5 days on, 3 weeks off for 6 cycles. Now, there's a way to test whether or not patients would likely to respond or derive a benefit from temozolomide, and that is with a genetic testing called MGMT. So if the tumor, if the glioblastoma is MGMT unmethylated, more likely than not, the temozolomide is not going to be adding a lot of benefit to the radiation. And there's a movement in neuro-oncology to try to prevent side effects from patients to remove the temozolomide during radiation and also in the adjuvant phase of treatment. I think the data is still there. I think you should speak to your treating physician about the pros and cons of either approach at this time. But patients who have methylated MGMT should definitely stay on temozolomide. Now, one of the side effects of cytotoxic chemotherapy is that it can cause marrow suppression. And we have seen that in patients who takes that 6 weeks of daily temozolomide. Some patients' blood count starts to drop in the second week, while other patients' counts to drop only after the radiation is done. There's no way that we can predict whose count will drop at what time and also how severely. So therefore, it is important that patients should get weekly monitoring with a complete blood count to check their white blood cells, to check their platelets every week during the 6 weeks of radiation and also, if necessary, after the radiation is done. With regards to other drugs that may lower the immune system, one of the drugs is dexamethasone. That is highly immunosuppressive. So if a patient can wean off the medication, the better that they will do, in my opinion. So I'll leave it at that, and maybe Dr. Bruce can add a few more things.
Yeah, thank you. That's an excellent question and a great response. I would agree with Dr. Wong on if you have the favorable MGMT status, that you should definitely get the Temodar because its effects are so well proven. And I would also say that dexamethasone seems to sort of blunt or block an immune response. So if you're receiving some kind of immunotherapy, the desire is to try and reduce the steroid levels as much as possible. Now, that being said, you know, the immunotherapy is really a not well understood phenomenon. The immune system is not understood very well, and by that I mean there are immune cells in your body that are very good at killing tumor cells, and there are also immune cells that sort of block this immune response. And the reason for that is there's the as your body is developing, you know, during as a newborn, your immune system is designed to have a checkpoint so that the immune system doesn't actually attack the body itself. I don't want to get too complicated with all that, but the main point being that there are some immune cells that are good for killing tumors, and there are some that block the killing of tumors. So interestingly, we don't really know whether chemotherapy and radiation make immunotherapy more effective, whereas you would be concerned that the radiation and chemotherapy is affecting the good immune cells, it may actually be affecting the problematic or bad immune cells that are blocking the response. So the final answer to the question is nobody really knows for sure whether radiation and or chemotherapy are helpful to an immune response or whether they hurt their immune response. And it may be that it actually depends on specifically what type of immunotherapy you're having. But in general, steroids are probably not helpful, and probably chemotherapy would tend to block an immune response, but we really don't know for sure.
Excellent, thank you. And we actually have two follow-up questions, one thanking Dr. Bruce and one thanking Dr. Wong. And actually, I'm going to start with Dr. Bruce because it can first. Thank you for your feedback regarding, it's also a follow-up question, however. Thank you for your feedback regarding EGFR for Dr. Bruce. He is status post-craniotomy and radiation and just completed first cycle of Temodar. MGMT was indeterminate. I am an oncology nurse, and my dad has been recently diagnosed with grade 4 glioblastoma. Due to his PS, he was not candidate for clinical trial, but now has KS. Now his KS is greater than 70%. So, Dr. Bruce, if you could explain some of the abbreviations here so everyone knows what they mean, and then also if you could address this question again in a general way. Thank you.
I'm sorry, what the question is about whether EGFR therapy would be helpful?
So she was very grateful about your comment about the EGFR, the initial question that she'd asked. which was if EGR status is mixed, would the patient be a candidate for targeted therapy? And you had addressed that question. And she was following it up with his status post-craniotomy and radiation and just completed first cycle of Temodor.
Oh.
Then MGMT was indeterminate, and then I'm an oncology nurse, and my dad has recently been diagnosed with grade 4 glioblastoma due to his PS. He was not candidate for clinical trial, but now his KS is greater than 70%.
So okay. So the KS score refers to Karnofsky Performance Score, KPS, and that's a score that goes from 1 to 100 that basically tells you how well a patient is functioning. So if you have a KPS of 100, that means you have completely normal function. If your KPS is 90, you may have some minor problems. KPS of 70 is sort of a cutoff point because below 70 generally means you have pretty significant problems with your daily activities and such things as walking and eating. And when someone is in very poor condition, it becomes hard to justify putting someone on a new experimental treatment that may have even more side effects and is of questionable benefit. So the question in this specific case, based on the MGMT status, which, again, as we alluded to in the last question, is a marker that tells you whether someone is more or less likely to benefit from Temodar. And what I would say in this case, if the MGMT is determinant, usually in most cases, Temodar is still given because it likely to still have benefit. And so it's something that you really want to discuss with your neuro-oncologist because there are other nuances, and without seeing all of the information on any given patient, it's hard to give anything more than general advice. But I would say Temodar still is likely to make sense for this particular patient, but by all means, if they should look into other potential experimental treatments, including EGFR-based therapies. And because the very nature of experimental therapies is that they're unproven, so it's very difficult to advocate for any particular experimental therapy over another. But again, something to discuss specifically with your neuro-oncologist.
Excellent. Thank you. And another. And Dr. Wong, do you want to add anything to that as well?
I agree with Dr. Bruce that this patient has a reasonable Karnofsky score, if the patient and the family is interested in clinical trial, one of the places that they can look is clinicaltrial.gov, and you can just put in glioblastoma, and it will list the number of different clinical trials that are available across the country, across the United States, as well as internationally. Now, sometimes traveling may be an issue, but it may. The patient or the family may be able to find out what is out there and also discuss with their treating physician about whether or not something that can be designed off protocol. And if the traveling is not too far, so for example, if it's just between New York and New Jersey, it may be worth a trip to talk to the place that has the clinical trial. So clinicaltrial.gov may be helpful for information.
Awesome. Thank you. And that actually will send you all of those additional resources. They're actually with your evaluation of the program, so you'll have all anything that was mentioned that's a resource. We'll be sure to send that along to you as well. So we do have a follow-up question actually also for Dr. Wong. So thank you also, Dr. Wong. You're the first doctor I've heard say to try the experimental therapy first if one qualifies. We went against traditional advice after my daughter's brain therapy and found a clinical trial. She's doing very well. The remaining tumor has not shrunk but also has not grown. I'm a professional healthcare provider as well as a caregiver. So again, do you want to comment on that concept of just how one makes a decision about choosing a treatment and how that happens for people, Dr. Wong?
Sure. So this is one of the very, very difficult decisions. Okay, so I think patients and their caretakers should come from the point of view of these two things. The first thing is that they have to understand that that there are therapies out there. Some are experimental, some are conventional. The experimental therapies are harder to get into because patients have to fulfill certain criteria. So, for example, a Karnofsky score of 70 or higher, or patients have to have a good resection. Patients have to have methylated MGMT or unmethylated MGMT. Now, those are new drugs that look promising. If patients qualify for a protocol treatment, the next question that the patient and their family is to answer is whether or not it is something that's doable. So, for example, a lot of the clinical trials, it requires traveling to the medical center. It may be on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, or once every 2 weeks. And in phase one study, actually, patients may need to be there every day for blood draw. Is it possible, or does that cause undue stress on the patient and the family? These are the things that they need to look at, whether or not they qualify for a trial, and if so, whether or not it is something that is doable. If something that's doable, by all means, participate in the trial, because if the trial drug works, great, because you will be the first beneficiary of the trial. If the trial doesn't work, you always have something to fall back on, and that is the conventional therapy. So, for those patients doesn't work out to enroll in a clinical trial, that's okay because you have conventional therapies to fall back on. And also, you can check with these patient organizations like Cancer Care or Chris Elliott Foundation, National Brain Tumor Foundation, that you can ask for advice or connect with specialists in your area so that you can get a second opinion about what potential therapies patients and their family can get.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Bruce, do you want to comment as well?
No, I just want to comment on one factor that the questioner asked about, and that was about what to do if the tumor is not shrinking, that it's staying the same. And I would say that part of a standard of care for any kind of clinical trial is if the tumor's not growing, we consider that good. And generally that means to continue the treatment that you're on. It's always great when a treatment causes a tumor to shrink or even disappear, but we're also happy if the tumor stays the same. It doesn't have to shrink in order for the treatment to be effective. So if your tumor is staying the same, then I would say continue the treatment that you're on.
Excellent. Thank you. And I have a question for Andrew Chesler, actually. We have a couple of caregivers on the call asking in behalf of a family member and their concerns. And I wondered if you could comment, Mr. Chesler, about the issue for caregivers, because they actually are often, you know, they often have a tremendous responsibility and sometimes the feeling is they don't really have a lot of support, and if you could comment on that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Caregivers are sort of the unsung members of the relationship between amongst the person diagnosed with cancer and, of course, the doctors, the medical team, and then there's the person who's at home with the person who's diagnosed. And that can be a very challenging role to play and sometimes isolating also. And we would certainly urge caregivers to reach out to to others to find support. It's helpful to have people who can relate to what you're going through. And there are many ways you could do that. Here at Cancer Care, we have, for our callers who are not in the New York area, we have in-person support groups. We have online support groups for caregivers. Caregivers are of people diagnosed with brain tumors, and you can access that through our website, cancercare.org. It would be a very valuable way to connect with others for your own emotional support and also to learn things and resources that some of the ones, for instance, that the doctors have talked about today.
Excellent. So, so everyone understands, and thank you so much for saying that. We do offer an online brain tumor caregiver support group now, and definitely, as Mr. Chesler had said, that's a nice way to network and support, and get some support for what you're going through, as well as of course your healthcare team. Well, I have to say this has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank our speakers. They've been phenomenal. And I also want, and they can't hear us applauding, but we are applauding them. They were terrific. And we also want to thank all of you who asked such great questions online. So we're also applauding all of you because your questions really helped us to expand on the topics and also make them for all of you to help more additional help and information as well. Now, most importantly, as we conclude the call today, we don't want any one of you to feel you're alone in coping with glioblastoma or with cancer in general. We want you to now know that you are part of our Cancer Care community of support. And in that respect, you are simply a phone call away from us. And you can call us at 1-800-813-4673, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. You can actually pose your questions and concerns. Also, for both our national and international participants, many people like to connect with us online as well, and you can just do that on our website. Now, I did say that I would, for those of you who have questions, and I know many of you do have questions we've still yet to answer, I want to connect you also with the National Cancer Institute. It's a wonderful resource. Now, of course, your healthcare team, of course, is the first go-to place because they're the ones who know everything about you to some extent. But then sometimes you like to get some additional information, what's called corroborating information. You just want to kind of explore a bit. So the National Cancer Institute can be contacted at 1-800-422-6237. Or at www.cancer.gov. And the National Cancer Institute does have on their website a chat feature where you can pose your question. So that's good for anyone in the U.S. or internationally. And you can then get responses to your questions. So people find that often very helpful and very immediate in terms of just getting some guidelines. They don't, again, have all the access to your medical records, but they can give you some just general guidelines that might be helpful to you. In addition, we also did mention a number of organizations that we will be sending again to you that are brain tumor-specific organizations, all of whom have both numbers that you can contact and websites chock full of information that would be very helpful to you. And also for clinical trial information, www.clinicaltrials.org. And again, you'll be getting that information as well, also handled through the National Cancer Institute or National Institute of Health. So you'll be getting all that information in addition to what we discussed today on the call. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. We do want you to feel connected to us. We have many other programs coming up that you may wish to participate in, many other services, and please do take advantage of them. We have many oncology social workers here who are really here to help you with your questions or concerns. So again, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for participating on this amazing call. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.